This is New Books in Science. I'm Maya Woolner, your podcast host for today. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to speak with Howard I. Kushner this morning. Dr. Kushner is the Nat C. Robertson Distinguished Professor of Science and Society Emeritus at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. He is also the John R. Adams Professor of History Emeritus at San Diego State University. As a historian of medicine and neuroscience, his areas of research include Tourette's syndrome, suicide, and left-handedness. He is the author of a number of books, including A Cursing Brain, The Histories of Tourette's Syndrome. Today, we'll be talking about his most recent book, On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder, and History, published by Johns Hopkins University Press in 2017. Thank you for joining us on New Books in Science today, Professor Kushner.
Thanks for having me, Maya. Appreciate it.
My first question is, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, as we used to say in psychiatry, it was overdetermined. On the one hand, I was left-handed, and my mother was also left-handed, but forced to switch to right-handedness when she was a child. And so I always wondered why was I left-handed? And then later, why was anyone left-handed for that matter? And then later when I was working on Tourette's syndrome, I worked in a clinic at Brown University Memorial Hospital of Brown in pediatrics, movement disorder clinic. And I noticed that a large number of our patients seemed to be left-handed and they had this disorder. So I immediately thought there must be some connection. And I began to get my colleagues in the clinic to take down information, ask whether their patient was left or right-handed. No one ever thought to do that. And we did a very small study and it looked like there was a connection. It turns out there really isn't, but it got me interested in looking at left-handedness and learning disabilities. And it turned out that almost every learning disability you could think of had been attached to left-handedness by somebody someplace along the line or was still being actively looked at that way. So it got me to look more carefully at how these connections were made, how the studies were done, what were the mechanics of them, what kinds of inventories in this case that people used to determine if someone was left or right-handed. So what seemed to be a simple question at first became very complex.
I think that really comes through actually in your book, that's for certain. In your preface, you mentioned that you were interested in writing a history of left-handedness as it relates to disability studies. And I was wondering, how have the methods and motivations of that discipline helped you better understand left-handedness?
Well, I think very much my work is sort of disability studies, although when I began working in this direction, especially when I was working on Tourette syndrome, I hadn't thought about making the connection explicitly. And then there was an article in the American Historical Review about the history of disability studies in history, and there was a long discussion in my book on Tourette syndrome, so I realized I was, in fact, in disability studies. More important, left-handers were assumed to be, because there was discrimination against them for so long in human history, they were assumed to have a variety of disorders because they were left-handed. And what I was trying to look at was, did the disabilities attached to left-handedness come from being left-handed, if it were true? And secondly, or was it the result of the intervention that was used throughout human history and in the West until really the 1950s, which was to switch left-handers to use their right hands for writing and other tasks. And then that in itself could have a negative effect on being left-handed. So there was this long debate in the literature, the more deeply I got into it, about whether left-handed itself was a kind of proxy or condition related to learning disabilities and disabilities in general, or was it the intervention that caused the disability. And then beyond that, the way the history of attitudes toward left-handedness was very much like the history of any other disability study. And so I guess I had been wrapped up in thinking this way without articulating at first and then being more self-conscious about it by the time I was writing the book.
Yeah, that's certainly very fascinating. Before we get into the different kinds of disabilities that were linked to left-handedness, let's first start with chapter 3, which I thought was a very interesting chapter where you write about the different measures for left-handedness. And I was wondering if you could explain to our listeners the different ways in which left-handedness is established and what the challenges are in measuring it through these different methods.
Right. One would think it would be very simple. You just pick out someone, see what hand they use, and then you're their left hand. And if they use the right hand, then they're right-handed. But it doesn't work that way. It turns out that there are very different definitions for left-handedness in lots of different societies and throughout. So there's no real agreement, oddly enough, on what constitutes left-handedness. And the way it's generally done in the West was through two survey inventories, one called the Annette Survey Inventory and the other called the Edinburgh or Oldfield. And what they do is they have a list of 10 or 12 ways people might report. So do you eat with your left hand? Do you write with your left hand or your right hand? Do you, in one of these, which hand do you strike a match? It's a sort of old inventory, but it's still there. So there's a little anachronistic. So it turns out that if you have 10 of these things that you use your left hand for, you're strongly left-handed. And if you have 10 of these things that you only use your right hand for, then you're strongly right-handed. And then there's everything in between. It's the stuff in between, right, that becomes problematic, because a lot of studies take a number of other studies. They do what's called a meta-analysis. They'll put a whole bunch of different studies together and then have a large enough number to make some statistical claim. The trouble is that not all of the studies use the same criteria for determining what they want to use. They don't all use this inventory. Some just say, you know, which hand do you use? So there's self-reporting, which is notoriously misleading. But beyond that, since the tendency had always been through human history and still in most of the world today to determine left-handedness by what culturally that people should or shouldn't use their left hand for. So for instance, eating, and some places where writing is not central to the culture or to the behaviors, throwing. So when you have all these different things, there's no real reliability when you do a whole bunch of things. And then there's two other really daunting problems, which is since so much of the population is shifted, when you ask if someone's left or right-handedness and you're trying to figure out if there's a genetic link, well, is the answer, I use my left hand now, or I was forced to change my left hand, so I'm really right-handed. I'm really left-handed, not right-handed. And then since this happens in early childhood, not everybody remembers what they were, and it's hard to know what the right answer is. Added to that is the discrimination against left-handedness means that in many societies, left-handedness has such a negative or connotation, sometimes associated with the profane as opposed to the right hand being the sacred, that it's underreported. So, for instance, I have a chapter, a discussion in this chapter about the Chinese reporting of left-handedness, which they, until the 1980s, reported to be 0.23%, which would make it the lowest possible, almost 0% of left-handers in society. So, so there's a cultural restriction. There is a actual memory restriction. So it's really hard to say what's the right way we can determine left-handedness. And as we see later on in my book, when people begin to do research and it doesn't turn out that left-handers turn out to be associated with the disability they thought, they might change the definition of left-handers to make it more inclusive. So they may, as some studies do, come up with a criteria called non-right-handedness. But since there's no set basis of how you figure that out, it becomes sort of arbitrary. And although these people aren't trying to distort their data, they are trying to find some relationship between handedness and these disabilities, and that can be done sometimes by changing the definition of what constitutes handedness itself.
So I noticed in your book that you actually reproduced the Oldfield survey, and I tried to do it myself, actually, and was very interested to find that I responded left-handed for 2 questions and 8 questions I was right-handed, and I tried to just go with my gut sense of how I respond. So this brings up the question, in order to be right or left-handed, do you have to get a 10 out of 10? And then, you know, if you are somewhere in between, like you mentioned previously, I'm interested to know about ambidexterity and if it really exists, or if it's just the sort of, you have to be determined in one way or another. And maybe you could talk a little bit also about the British ambidexterity movement, which I found quite fascinating.
Sure. When it comes to the survey inventory, that's what you start off with. You can see in the, I think it's on page 32 of the book, you see that they ask all these questions of which hand do you use to do certain things. So 10 out of 10 would make you strongly left-handed. 10 out of 10 negatives. 10 out of 10 positives would make you strongly right-handed. And then it's fair game in the middle. So it just depends on how many non-right-handed things people do that a study might decide to define that as what we're looking for, which is not necessarily strong left-handedness, but weaker right-handedness. So you're relatively strong right-handed by the inventory. The thing is, you probably don't strike a match very often.
No.
And right, and I don't use scissors a lot, mainly because I'm left-handed, and I sweeping I don't do with a broom very much myself.
That was my left-handed response, actually.
So you know, it sort of gets arbitrary, and so some things that aren't there also are left-sidedness that these inventories don't do. So, for instance, I mean, people are either left or right eared.
Yes.
They're left or right footed, right? So as a result, these things, you know, are not normally left-handers are in theory make up about 10 to 12% of the population, right? But when it comes to hearing, right, which is not on this inventory, it's about 50-50. In other words, 50% are right-eared and 50% are left-eared. They are one or the other, right? They're lateralized. In other words, there's one side that's dominant. And the same is true with footed. And then there's the advantage that comes from, in the modern world, that the Chinese being very strongly against left-handedness as a criteria until recently when they discovered that ping pong players had a great advantage being left-handed. And all of a sudden, the Chinese were pushing for ping pong players to be left-handed. And even in tennis today, there are certain tennis professionals who have trained themselves to be left-handed, as hard as that may seem to be, because there's some advantage and surprise of being left-handed. So what used to be seen as a negative trait is now seen as a positive one. And how do you measure what those people are? Are they when they learn to use their left hand to play tennis, or are they now considered left-handed, right? And so what time do we know? So the other thing that makes it hard to count it is that, let's say that there is a gene for left-handedness, so no one's fine that people keep touting that they're almost there. But if there is, right, then you should be able to find that gene early on in development being important. But actually, we don't really, children don't really generally choose their left or right hand until they're 3 years or older, or almost 3 years or older. So as a result, when you try to figure out if someone's left or right handed, and if it turns out that the real key is before age 3, well, we hardly ever do studies mm-hmm. with children under the age of 3. So it makes it hard to get the right kind of population. So I really thought this would be a very simple thing to answer, mm-hmm. right? Why are there so many left-handers? What causes left-handedness? Done back to my other stuff. But it turned out the deeper I got in it, the more confusing it was. So for instance, as you just asked before, what's ambidextrous? Well, does ambidextrous mean you can do everything with either hand, mm-hmm. or does it mean that you can do some things with one hand and some things with another? And if in studies they're all labeled, some label one way as ambidextrous and the other way is not ambidextrous, when you put them together, you don't have a mishmash of things. So there's a lot of skepticism about whether or not there really is a true thing called ambidexterity. But a lot of people certainly believe it. So for instance, as you brought up before, at the turn of the 19th to 20th century, there was a big movement in Britain and ultimately later in the United States called the Ambidextrous Cultural Society. And the argument, it was actually one of its leaders was the head of the Boy Scouts, Baden Powell. And it argued that if you could get people to use their left hand as well as their right hand, use both sides, then you get to both sides of your brain. And there was a lot of literature, there's a lot of argument about that. And some of the most influential writers on handedness at the turn of the century took sides in this issue. So for instance, the British Boy Scouts, to encourage people to be ambidextrous, made them shake hands with their left hand rather than the right hand.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So for the sake of clarity, you've mentioned asymmetry and laterality, and I think maybe it would be good to let our listeners know, clarify what those terms mean in this context. And then also my secondary question to that would be, could you also explain why it has been so important for some researchers to link left-handedness and brain or cerebral laterality?
Good, because they're both very much connected. The first thing is, in the lingo of people who do brain research, right, and just in general language, the term laterality means what side is dominant. Right? Asymmetry is the fact that both hemispheres of the brain are not exactly the same. Right? In fact, almost nothing from proteins all the way up are symmetrical. Most things are asymmetrical, uneven. And so what you want to do when you're working with handedness, the assumption, which may be a wrong assumption to begin with, is that you could look at the left hand and that means that your dominance would be in your right brain, right hemisphere, and your right hand's dominance is supposed to be in your left hemisphere. But it turns out it's not true. In other words, only 18% of people who are categorized as left-handed turn out, through now we have much better scanning techniques that aren't invasive, that they turn out only 18% are right-brained instead of, if it were really left is one side, right's the other, you would have 100%. And then 5% of right-handers are right-brain. Well, since there are many more right-handers than left-handers, that's 5% of a much larger number. So in just raw numbers, there are more right-handed right-brainers than there are left-handed right-brainers. But in the popular press and in popular discussion, right, the assumption is that the left hand somehow or other is a proxy for the right brain. So you don't have to actually look at the cerebral hemisphere at all, but it's not true.
My second, or sort of a follow-up question to that would be then, why is there so much cachet to have left brain dominance?
Well, I don't know if there's that much cachet. I don't know if there's cachet.
Well, in the sense that certain kinds of attributes are linked to left right brain.
You know. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. Like drawing on your left side or drawing on your right side, stuff like that. Well, It's hard to say why there is that much, but one of them is that, you know, for years there's been so much discrimination. I mean, throughout human history, right? So much discrimination, and still in most of the cultures in the world, there's discrimination against left-handers that are restrictions about what they can use their left hands for. That the pushbacks when it came, right, came in the notion that the left part of the left-handers were in their right brains, which they're not necessarily, but let's just say they are, right? And therefore, the right brain is more creative, and therefore, left-handers are more creative, they're smarter. And so there have been these societies of left-handers that grow up. There's a famous store in Britain, and now they're all over the Western world, and even in India, they cater to left-handers. So part of the pushback against the discrimination against left-handers was the notion that they were superior in terms of talent. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that supports it, but when you actually do a study of large numbers of people, it doesn't support that. So I think the reason is that we're looking at the wrong thing, right? The right thing, the correct thing to examine would be that population, both right-handers and left-handers, who have dominance in the normally non-dominant hemisphere. So that would mean what we should be looking at is not left-handers or right-handers, but people who are right-brained in terms of language.
I see. So the handedness is sort of a proxy way in which researchers have tried to access that, but it turns out through various studies that link is quite tenuous. So I want to talk a little bit about your discussion in chapter 2, where you introduce the readers to two figures who loom large in the history of left-handedness. That's the Italian criminologist Cesare Lombroso and the French anthropologist Robert Hertz, both of whom were working in the 19th and early 20th centuries. I was wondering if you could recount this debate to our listeners and expand on why this intellectual dispute remains relevant or not to the contemporary history of left-handedness.
Yeah, it's actually my favorite chapter. It's the one that's most history, I guess. Maybe that's why. Lombroso was the founder of modern criminology, and he had this. He led the large school of followers in Turin in Italy, and he argued that as humans became more and more civilized, from his point of view, remember we had a whole different attitude toward what we consider to be the direction of cultures and movements, that right-handers, the more right-sided and right-handed the people were, the more advanced they were, right? And he argued that primitive people were left-handers, and he said so were criminals, and he had and left-sided. So he did, many of these studies were based on skull size, which was a big thing then. So if you couldn't get to the brain the way we do now, you could put a bunch of BBs inside of a skull and measure the volume. So, and he looked at the visages of these people, what they looked like, and took pictures of them. And it turned out that people who came from non-Western cultures, of course, the way that it was presented, were seen as more primitive, and primitivity was seen as more left-handed. Now, this isn't true at all, right? People were not. Right, but it became a central argument of his. But he said that these people were atavistic; they were throwbacks to previous generations of humans. And Lombroso himself actually thought we really couldn't do anything about it. You couldn't change these people. So, but you should just essentially, it led to this notion later on that Lombroso would not have endorsed, but which would come to haunt him, that these people should be eliminated. And from a genetic point of view, that if you want to have fewer people, right, who have this trait, then that's what you would do, assuming that it was a genetic thing and it was true. And on the other hand, there was this curious thing. Lombroso, right, was descended from a very prominent Jewish family in Italy. And this is the time of anti-Semitism. It's not the only time, but it's one of the strong, you know, recurrences of anti-Semitism in the late 19th century, Italy and, in fact, France and all over Europe. And so when it came to Jews, he said, well, look, he said, it's true these other people were criminals because they couldn't help it, but if Jews are ever criminals, it's because of discrimination against them. But you can see how someone could pick up the rest of the argument, the way people look, that their difference, their inability to be integrated in the society as how that was tied very much to anti-Semitism. On the other hand, Robert Hertz, who was French, wrote this long defense. He was a student of Durkheim's, of left-handedness and against discrimination of left-handers, saying that, right, by doing this, you're essentially taking people's half the brain and you're paralyzing them and they can't use it. And he said, even if there is a physical difference between left-handers and right-handers, right, we should look at what the benefit from getting rid of the discrimination would be. From this point of view, of course, it was code for him to be talking about the Dreyfus Affair and the discrimination against Jews in France and, in fact, in Europe. And what he was saying was that it was no different to discriminate against left-handers than it was to discriminate against Jews, and the society would lose a great deal as a result of both. And this is not just I just didn't attach this. He puts this in his letters to his wife. He decides he's a socialist, but he's against the Franco-Prussian War initially, but he was willing to go fight in World War I, even though he had done his service, because as he wrote to his wife Alice, he said that not enough Jewish blood can be spread on the French soil, and that would show the patriotism of the French Jews. And he was tragically killed when he was only 35 in the front of World War I the Battle of the Marne. So you have these two strands, right? You have the left-handedness is a negative trait, or left-handedness is a positive trait. And that's where the ambidexterity comes in. You use both of them.
So we've been sort of talking around the fact of discrimination, as well as the attribution of positive values to left-handedness. So let's really get into the discrimination aspect. At various points in your book, you discuss how left-handedness has been linked to mental deficiency, learning disabilities, criminality, as in the case of Lombroso, femininity, homosexuality, schizophrenia, autism, and psychosis. So I was wondering if you could give us, your listeners, some ideas of how these links were made to various qualities, and who sort of advocated for that kind of negative view of left-handedness.
Yeah, you know, there's if you look at the history of this, what you find is, and initially the discrimination is for religious or cultural or other reasons, but it's not seemingly, from our point of view, scientifically based. What's interesting is the same discrimination was justified under a scientific basis in the early 20th century and later. So the science didn't necessarily, you know, make people look more objectively at this difference. So given the strong undercurrent in belief and the strong cultural values, and for instance, if it takes something like the Zulu in South Africa, if a child persists in using his left hand, if it's being slapped and told not to do it, tied down, they'll take the child, they'll dig a hole and pour boiling water in it and stick their left hand in it so they can't use their left hand anymore, which is pretty extreme. But the same sorts of things kept occurring. So what people were doing was assuming that that left-handedness was by itself, ipso facto, a disorder, and would manifest itself through any of these sorts of things, right? And so the dominant intervention in the early 20th century, late 19th century, up until the 1950s, was to force people to be switched from left-handed to right-handed. Given the discrimination against left-handers, in school, they were seen as having more learning disabilities. They were humiliated in class. In fact, it became self-fulfilling because of discrimination against these kids. They put a dunce cap on. And I think in the book, I have many examples of this sort of thing. So it looked as if it was left-handedness that caused this retardation because of the whole society's movement against left-handers. But one of the things most associated, just one example that the book talks about autism and all the other sorts of things, but one thing that was associated with left-handedness was that there were a lot of stutterers. And the assumption was, right, by one group of people, that stuttering caused that left-handers were stutterers because they were left-handed. But this one group of people who actually created modern studies of these disabilities, but particularly of stuttering at the University of Iowa, wondered what would happen if they took the stutterers that they were treating. And it turned out most of them had been switched hands. Even some had been switched because they got polio from right-handed to left-handed. What would happen if they switched them back to their original dominant hand? What would happen to their stuttering? So they did this. And it turned out, which I found to be absolutely amazing, right, that the stuttering went away as a result of their switching back. One of the best examples of this is the King George VI, the famous movie, The King's Speech, which I'm sure almost everyone's seen. And that what's not emphasized enough in the film is that the king was, when he was between 6 and 7, was forced to switch from his right hand to his left hand. And then his stuttering developed. And although he still continued to do some things with his left hand. But the interesting thing in the film that isn't explained as fully as it might be is that when you put earphones on the king and he can't hear himself speak and he just has to read from a text, he doesn't stutter. And that's because what stuttering in part is a slow transmission, just a millisecond, right, from what you speak to what you hear. And so stutterers continue to hear what they just said, so it's hard for them to get on to the next word, but if they can't hear it, So that suggests that stuttering has a lot to do with hemispheric dominance and the interference about what might be a natural sort of selection for a particular person. In terms of autism, as one example, or attention deficit, or schizophrenia, I'll give you a very simplistic but not misleading way this is related. So, for instance, in autistic children, or children with autism, in children with autism, and there's a big spectrum from very severe disorder to just shyness, maybe. In that spectrum, what you have is over focus, right, on one side, hyper dominance, really. And in kids who have severe autistic disorder, they can sit and watch something all day long. They cannot contextualize what they see. And one of the things that's sometimes attached to autism is the inability to have empathy. So in a way, autism is kind of hyper-focused. And it's a simple way to put it, all right? But it at least shows the way you think about it. But whereas you have attention deficit, there is no dominance. And dominance is really important, right? But not hyper-dominance. And so in attention, people with attention deficit disorder, the both hemispheres seem to be non-dominant. And so the lack of dominance, and if severe, that one might explain some schizophrenias as well. I hope that makes sense.
No, that's very fascinating. I was also very surprised to hear about the reconverting young students back to their original dominant hand actually decreased stuttering. I thought that study was extremely fascinating. I was wondering, actually, though, in the context of maybe Western Europe and North America, when the practice of actually retraining left-handedness into right-handedness really got off the ground.
Well, you know, I thought when I started this and started looking at that, it would be like the 1920s or 30s. And I was interested in this, of course, because my mother had been switched and she had certain learning disabilities as a result. But it turns out every time I would give an interview about these stutters being switched over, and especially if I were doing one, a talk show thing, all these people would call up and say, well, this happened to me in like 1950. And I had those ones of Western Europe and in France, like people born in the 1960s. And so it went away slowly and not entirely. And it's still in the West, although now it's no longer, it's almost disappeared. It's not disappeared among migrants to Western countries from more traditional societies. And so if you want to see where the discrimination against handedness is, it's still in the United States among certain immigrant families. But one of my key interviews is with this guy who was born in the 1960s, whose father was a pediatrician who forced him to switch and who as a result stuttered. And so the prejudice is still there. But and if you go out of the West, then it's at least 10% of the population of the world is probably being discriminated against, which has certain kinds of effects. It's the discrimination that causes the disability rather than the handedness that causes the other disability.
I think that's a very important insight. Let's talk about the positive values now that have been attributed to left-handedness, including creativity, genius, talent. You know, our famous list of left-handers includes people like Barack Obama, Leonardo da Vinci. So I was wondering, is there a long history also of the opposite of attributing positive values to left-handedness, or is this a backlash against, millennia of discrimination?
I think mainly the latter, but not entirely. I mean, there are, as I have in the book, there are people, right, who, who saw this as a negative thing, right? In ancient Greece, there were some people, there was Lao Tzu in China, but so from time to time, there are people that rise up or have some other vision of left-handedness, but it's certainly minority. And even where it's positive, it's sort of fudged a little bit. So really, historically, humans have seen left-handedness as a negative trait, right, and acted on it through most of human history. Now, in One interesting thing we might be able to say, though, is that where the discrimination against left-handedness is less than in some other societies, it's almost a barometer of the way people treat diversity. So the willingness to see left-handedness as a legitimate form of human behavior probably reflects a particular society's values in terms of difference to begin with. And I have some examples in the book about different traditional societies where, and some where they try to get people to no longer be left-handed through positive reinforcement and others that are negative. And the ones that are more negative are more negative against any kind of difference in their society.
That's really interesting. So let's move into the later 20th century. I was wondering if you could explain to our listeners what the Geschwind hypothesis is and why it was important in the 1980s.
Yeah, Norman Geschwind was probably the most important and influential neurologist of the mid-century, and his students are still out there practicing. And by all accounts, he was brilliant. And he had already created a whole new field called behavioral neurology, where he saw the relationship between behaviors not as psychodynamic, but rather as neurological. But when it came to looking at handedness, he argued that that normally in utero, right, there's a slower development of the left side, and as a result, different kinds of abilities slowly develop in terms of response. But also, what he argued was that some kind of insult in utero, right, and depending on when it took place in utero, right, would have effect of sort of flipping around the developmental areas so that the thymus, which works against infection and immunity, would develop slowly, so it would be effective. But if it was forced up by some other area, then as a result there could be more deficits. And in particular, he argued this way, that normally left-handers are more males than females, despite the fact that other people in other ages have always sensed a female behavior, but of course it's not. And the reason is he attached it to testosterone, right? Because testosterone, an extra shot of testosterone in a male in utero, might slow down the development of the immune system. So he argued that these disabilities that are seen with left-handers come from the fact that there's been something that's affected their ability to develop normally in terms of immune response, and also in terms of handedness, and also in terms, so he would say that handedness, right, was kind of a marker, but he would for these disabilities. But he began to change his mind as he looked at this more carefully. But he had attached through studies a variety of immune disorders and learning disabilities to in utero insults. And so it was very influential. When he published this work with his two colleagues, Galliberta being one of them, that it got an incredible amount of publicity and sort of pushed everything else out of the order, because it gave a environmental explanation for handedness, where other people have been trying to get research funded looking at genetic origin of handedness.
Maybe just for the point of comparison, you can explain what a genetic model is for our listeners.
Sure. A genetic model is that there's some abnormality, inherited abnormality or difference that leads to left-handedness. So people have looked for, is there a gene, right? And they do that through pedigrees. Or in other words, you take large populations of families and you look back and you see, you know, was the grandfather left-handed? Was the grandmother left-handed? What side was left-handed? All right. And it does turn out that when you look at handedness, that if one of your parents is left-handed, you have a 19% chance of becoming left-handed, which is much higher than if both your parents are right-handed, which is like under 9%. So that suggests a recessive gene. In other words, a gene that's passed down over time. And then the question is, how do we find it? Right. And So people try to find it by looking at other animal models where there's asymmetry. In other words, you know, where one, where the, are they left or right sided? Now, it may seem silly to think about this, but if you take rats or laboratory mice are 50-50 left and right handed. In fact, all animals pretty much are 50-50. And if you just take the mice that are left pawed and you just mix them with other left pawed mice, you still get 50-50. So so you try to see what it is, right, that makes this change in a in an animal, or in some cases in a, even a snail, or what's, you know, the direction of movement of the cilia in the around the organs of the body, or in, within the body itself. And so people try, they can't find a gene for left-handedness itself, so they're trying to look for a candidate gene that would be tied to something that's that looks at asymmetry. Right. So if you could find this gene that, if you remove it, gets rid of the asymmetry and makes symmetry, right, then you should be able to then move that up to humans. But so far, the studies have not been able to do that, although from time to time there are claims that someone has found the candidate gene.
So I read in your book that about 10 to 12% of the human population, the human species, has been left-handed. And this was sort of measured in the context of since the Stone Age. And that really struck me and impressed me as a statistic. And I was wondering how that kind of number was established for such a long period of time, when we would have only had, obviously, archaeological remains of humans from such a long time ago.
Yeah, it does seem odd, doesn't it? But it's not so odd, because handedness has been determined back to Neanderthals by looking at cave paintings is one thing, hand tracings. So if the left hand is the traced hand, right, then the person doing the tracing is most likely right-handed. And if you look at the tracings through back in the earliest, as far back as we can find these tracings, right, it's about 90% right hand and 10% left hand. And then also, because we've developed much better techniques in archaeology, looking at the way tools are shaped, whether they be worked for a left-handed or right-handed, or even simple little things like just a hammer you'd hit on a rock to split it, right? What direction that would be. So it turns out that there is actually pretty good evidence that humans have been this way as so long as there have been Homo sapiens sapiens and before.
That's really interesting, a really interesting method to try and understand that. So who is Michael Karbalas, and how would you describe his contribution to left-handedness?
In a way, he's been the most consistent writer about left-handedness for the last half century almost. He's a New Zealand psychologist, widely respected, and his take on the causes of left-handedness very much reflect each time what the dominant methodological approach is, not just to handedness, but in general to the problems about behavior. And so Karbalas begins his career by writing a book called The Lopsided Ape. And in it, he essentially argues that humans are unique, that they have the reason that they have they're so asymmetrical when it comes to language, when it comes to their hands, is because of language. Because language begins first with gesture. It's only found in humans, and it comes from human culture. And humans, although all animals communicate, humans use this system of metaphoric language, which is much more sophisticated. And as a result, handedness reflects brain dominance. And then we talked about earlier about those things that are dominant in the right hemisphere. Karbalas makes this argument, makes it very strongly through, reviews everyone else's work, is a very good critic of the limitations of different kinds of studies. But yet, in the last half decade, he's now moved to the other side, arguing that that handedness actually is the result of a gene rather than the result of the culture, rather than being environmental. It's biological. And yet the evidence that he uses isn't any different from the evidence he used before, but it's a new reading, a new interpretation of the same evidence. And trying to figure out why that's so, it seems to me that people like Corbalis, who are really good at what they do, want to stay in where the action is. But if you want to stay where the action is in terms of handedness, and you want to do a big study and you want to check out whether it's genetic or not, if you don't do a genetic study, you're not going to get funded. And so although I'm not saying that he's doing this because he doesn't believe in what he's doing, but it's just that that's the big ball game in town now, is large studies of studies, meta-analyses, right, that take a lot of funding to do the study. And as a result, if you want to stay where the action is, you sort of have to move into genetics. And that's where we are right now. So the environmental arguments, even the ones like Geshwin would make, are no longer in vogue. And this, yeah, I'm sorry, I was just saying, this just, what I'm just trying to say in many, too many words is that that what's going on is that whatever the dominant skills are needed in terms of research, they influence what we look at as much as the things we look at influence the methodologies we use. Make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It seemed to me when I read the anecdote or the story about Lombroso and Hertz that the dominant research binary is really between biology and culture. And it seems like you've just elaborated that the biology argument or the biology practice is really the one that is at the forefront now of left-handed research. But my question would be, can one ever actually disprove the environmental or the cultural explanation?
No, and I think this goes to the heart of really what my take-home message of my book is. Everyone's looking for the cause of left-handedness, as if left-handedness has only one cause, right? One gene, one culture. But it would seem to me there are many routes to get there. It's a syndrome. It's a collection of signs and reports, you know, what hand you use, how left-handed you are, what your childhood was like, what in utero was. So there's no reason to think that everybody becomes left-handed for the same reasons, because not everyone who's left-handed actually acts the same, right? And so we have to think of it like any other syndrome. When I worked on Tourette's syndrome, I don't think that there's a single cause of Tourette's syndrome either. And for all those syndromes, think about pneumonia. You can have pneumonia, and there are lots of ways you get pneumonia, right? So I think we have to stop looking for the single cause of left-handedness and understand that it's a complex result of culture and biology and go from there.
Well, that seems like a good place to end our interview. Thank you so much for spending time with me today on New Books in Science to talk about your book.
Thank you, Maya.
This has been New Books in Science. Thank you for listening.